This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good afternoon, everyone. How are you all doing? Are you still buzzing from a very electrifying weekend, I can imagine? Yeah? That's good. My name is Ntila Chingayipe. I'm a journalist and filmmaker, and I'll be moderating this afternoon's session. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are meeting on the land of the Wurundjeri people and pay my respects to their elders, both past and present, and also acknowledge any elders that might be with us this evening. Broadside here at Melbourne Town Hall is presented by the Wheeler Centre. And before I introduce our very esteemed panel, if you're on social media, the hashtag to use is #Broadside2019, and you can tag at Wheeler Centre if you're doing that. So I'm going to introduce the panel, and they're all incredibly accomplished, and I feel like I should take the time to go through their bios because they've worked very hard to achieve these amazing things. And I'll begin by introducing the person closest to me, Fatima Bhutto. And she was born in Kabul, Afghanistan, and grew up in Syria and Pakistan. She's the author of 6 books of fiction and non-fiction. Her debut novel, The Shadow of the Crescent Moon, was long listed for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. Songs of Blood and Sword, the memoir she wrote about the life and assassination of her father, Murtaza Bhutto, was published to great acclaim. Her most recent book is New Kings of the World, a lively look at the forces that are challenging America's cultural dominance of the world. She's the author of Whispers of the Desert, a volume of poetry published in 1997 by Oxford University Press Pakistan, where Fatima was 15 years old. Please make Fatima feel very welcome. And next to Fatima is Tracy McMillan Cottam, and she is an award-winning Associate Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University and a faculty affiliate at Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Her work has been recognized in the US and internationally for the urgency and depth of her incisive critical analysis of technology, higher education, class, race, and gender. Her most recent book, Thick and Other Essays, is a critically acclaimed Amazon bestseller that situates Black women's intellectual tradition at its center. Thick recently won the Brooklyn Public Library Literary Prize and is a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award in Nonfiction. Along with Roxane Gay, she is co-host of Here to Slay, providing listeners with incisive reads on politics and popular culture, a self-styled Black feminist podcast of your dreams. Please make Tracy feel very welcome. And sitting next to Tracy is Gia Tolentino, and she explores the intersections of feminism, the internet, and pop culture in startlingly original ways. Her first book, Trick Mirror, a collection of essays, is a New York Times bestseller and has earned her comparisons to Joan Didion. She was recently described by Rebecca Solnit as the best young essayist at work in the US. A staff writer at The New Yorker, she was previously a contributing editor at The Hairpin and a deputy editor at Jezebel. She also served in Kyrgyzstan in the Peace Corps. Very cool. And last but certainly not least, Aminatou Sow is a writer and cultural commentator. She co-hosts with Anne Friedman the hit podcast Call Your Girlfriend, which tackles the intricacies of feminism, pop culture, and politics. Together, she and Anne coined the term shine theory, a practice of mutual investment committed to collaborating with rather than competing against other people, especially other women. She's a member of the Sundance Institute's Directors Advisory Group and previously led social impact marketing at Google. She's also the founder of Tech Lady Mafia, a group that increases opportunities for women in tech. She was named one of Forbes' 30 Under 30 in Tech. So I'm very excited about this conversation, and I don't know about you, but I sort of feel like the conversation around feminism in many ways has sort of been hijacked to fit neoliberal economics, this idea that, you know, if you as the individual fix you know, do whatever you need to do, then success will instantly come. Or that if you just lean in, then, you know, we're almost closer to gender equality. And I'm curious, and I might start with you, Tracy, on this. You know, is it as simple? Is a gender equal future simply, is it as simple as leaning in?
Oh, no.
Okay, so, all right. So I'm the sociologist. I'm supposed to say this smartly. I'll give this a shot. So the crux of this modern conversation about whose feminism one wants to embody and champion is really a very old question about whether or not feminism is about equality or if it is about justice. So a conversation about equality is going to take as its priors that however you got the resources you presently have, right, we will turn the page and start anew. So that would erase everything like colonization, forced migration, enslavement. It would wipe clean sort of the primitive accumulation of capital upon which modern feminism concerns itself. So that means you're going to talk about income inequality, but you're not going to talk about where the income came from. You're going to talk about wages, but you aren't going to talk about wealth and property, right? So that's that conversation about equality, and that's where lean in and that whole, you know, new age white feminism, corporate feminism, trickle-down feminism, whatever you like to call it, fits in very nicely. Because it says that if you discipline yourself enough, right, that you can get some sort of individual parity with some, you know, amorphous male counterpart. The problem with that is that that's just called competition. That's not feminism, right? And we already had competition. That's the premise upon which capitalist exchange is built. Competition is baked right in there in the crust. You actually really don't have to go reinvent it. Now, the feminism that would question, well, where did the wealth come from? Right? Now, that's a very different kind of feminism and the type that people who are outside of mainstream feminism are often talking about. So that's non-Western often and certainly usually is arriving from or deriving from the practice and the theory of non-white feminists, non-gender conforming feminists, queer feminists, feminists of color, etc., who have always borne the brunt of the inequality that capitalism necessitates, and so have always seen very clearly that you cannot have feminism that is about justice and have an unjust system of capitalism embedded in it. And for that, there's no amount of leaning in or out that's going to fix that problem. As long as poor women are the ones cleaning your bathrooms, it doesn't matter who the hell's leaning in the corporate suite. Hmm.
Gia, if I can come to you, because you write about the internet and you've written about feminism as well, and I'm curious if the internet has perhaps exacerbated, you know, mainstream feminism in terms of being, you know, in the ways that it's been hijacked by capitalism. And I wonder, you know, being able to distill something into a hashtag like, you know, girl power or something is as a product of the internet in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, well, what Tressie was just saying made me think, I always think about the Toni Morrison gave a speech at Barnard in the, like, 79 or something, where she said, you know, you are being given more freedom and the purpose of freedom is to make other people more free. Like, she sort of compared the position of feminists with privilege to the stepsisters in Cinderella who had learned a way of achieving comfort that was predicated on the suffering of other women. And I always think about that when, like, this very obvious point that people, you know, that it should have been so obvious for forever. But then, so then came the internet. And I often think about, my entire career has been predicated on the last 10 years of marketable feminism. Like, I wouldn't have a job, I would never have been able to have a job if not for the fact that suddenly, you know, post Lean In, like kind of post Jezebel, feminism was something that corporations were willing to take out ads against. And so I'm kind of complicit. I've kind of been wrestling with my own complicity with this kind of the market feminism that has become dominant. And I think that one of the reasons the internet has both like opened up this, you know, as with many things, the internet has opened up this incredibly fertile ground for disagreement and, you know, the internet has opened up the space for the dissent, the necessary dissent that I now think is becoming, it's closer to becoming the consensus than ever, that mainstream feminism is basically empty, you know? But I think there's something about the internet itself revolves around this idea that kind of the teleological purpose of a human is to become as visible and appealing to as many people as possible. And when you get that idea combining with a kind of pernicious capitalistic feminism, what you get, like you get this sort of lock of this thing where the kind of implicit idea is that the more monetizable you are, the more worthy, the more feminist, like the best thing a woman could be is maximally visible and maximally appealing and maximally rich. And that was really, I mean, when I worked at Jezebel, like this was something that, you know, let's say we would report on like a female business, like a CEO that was doing something shitty. And you know, you would get the reflexive, like, you know, why is a feminist site tearing down other women? Like she is doing this thing. We should all be like supportive of women that are successful. And there is something about the things that the internet tends to prioritize visibility and appeal that has kind of hardened this. But at the same time, I mean, I think part of the reason we're having this conversation is because of the spaces that have been opened up by the internet too.
I mean, actually, I'm curious, just picking up on what Gia talked about, I mean, the women that have been able to monetize as a result of this. And I think about celebrities and very rich, wealthy women that have taken on feminism and claimed it as a brand in many ways. And I wonder what, from your perspective, complexities that opens up in terms of reinforcing inequality.
Yeah, I mean, this conversation is so fascinating to me because I am, as someone who has always called herself a feminist, like when it was not cool on the playground, it was not, even when I was in college, it was not cool, that we are living in this moment now where people are actively claiming the mantle of feminist is so, that is so, it blows my mind every morning because I, you know, I was like, there used to be a cost that came with that label, right? And for, you know, I don't know, for like Reese Witherspoon to be able to call herself a feminist, I was like, people have died for that. Like, and it's just like very real, like there were stakes and now there are no stakes. And on one hand, I think that it is, you know, the point of all freedom movements is that everyone wants to get free. So I, you know, like I am not mad that, you know, like, celebrities are calling themselves feminists. I was like, great, like now the word has a little less power. But also the potency is diminished, right? And a thing that I think about a lot is that in the label has kind of always been meaningless to me because I am like, are you a feminist or do you do feminism? Are you an activist or do you do activism? Those two things are never the same. And so I really chafe a little bit at the idea that, you know, corporate feminism has any kind of power or bite, actually, because even people who are not sophisticated thinkers, like, understand that it's all a sham. Like, I am not threatened by a grown woman who calls herself a CEO. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this person has no power, right? And so, to me, like, a thing that is that's interesting about this conversation about corporate feminism or like capitalist feminism, I was like, these people are all powerless people. Like if you look at the actual system, and it's actually, I'm like, this is a beautiful trick of patriarchy, is that we are all fighting about like, oh, like lean in, is it a thing, is it not? And I'm like, the patriarchy is still doing evil things every day. And that conversation is it's a huge distraction almost. And I don't believe that it has the power that we say that it does. I'm like, these, even Sheryl Sandberg has walked away from Lean In. Like she has, in the wake of her husband dying, has said that one of the limitations of that book was that she didn't understand until she was a widow that she had a support system that enabled her to like live the life that she did. And she's like, if I had to do it again, I wouldn't do it again. And even that book, for all of the polemic about like, you know, like, is Sheryl Sandberg a feminist or not, I don't think that we are, as a society, are as confused about what is going on here as we are all letting on. You know, like, I think that these systems have as much power as we give them, but in terms of, like, women aligning themselves with capitalism, I'm like, that's not new. the internet makes it, the internet weaponizes it in a way that to me actually just showcases how little power women have. I was like, if your whole center of power is that you have an Etsy store, you know, and that's the, like the girl bosses are supposed to be fighting about girl boss shit. I was like, well, like you have nothing. Mm. This is in the grand scheme of what is going on, you have nothing. But to your question about celebrity, I also think that a thing that is happening is that it is palatable now for celebrity to align itself with some forms of activism, very toothless kind of activism, because it doesn't have a, there's no cost associated with it now, and it has cachet. But I refuse to believe that, you know, that people think that this is doing something. You know, I just, that is not, that case has not been made to me, that there is any power in what these people are doing.
Fatima, just picking up on that, in doing something, historically, when I think about feminism, a lot of the movements have stemmed out of protest. I think about the Russian Revolution, it was working class women that were using that to highlight systemic inequality. And it almost feels as though those waves of protest, apart from recently Me Too, aren't currently in the climate of the discourse around feminism. And I wonder, how have we shifted away from the focus of looking at the very marginalized women who feminism, you know, seeks to ensure that they have any economic opportunities?
Yeah, I think what Aminatou said is so interesting, because what neoliberalism has done is it's totally defanged feminism. In many ways, it disarticulates so many things. So, you know, I mean, under today's rubric, Margaret Thatcher would be a feminist just because she wore skirts, you know, or she had a handbag. You know, look at, just to go back to Sheryl Sandberg, I think the effect, it is that they don't do anything, that there's no stakes, but it's also that what they do is harmful. So I'm less interested in Sheryl Sandberg's book, and I'm more interested in the fact that when she went to India, she embraced Narendra Modi, under whose watch thousands of women were raped and murdered in the Gujarat riots of 2002. Mm-hmm. I think that is doing something. I think when we talk about, again, you know, if you were here in the morning, we spoke about Hillary Clinton, who is problematic in exactly the same way. Mm. You know, I don't know if you remember that picture of the Situation Room when Osama bin Laden was killed and Hillary had her hand over her mouth. And she had to clarify that that wasn't because she was shocked at the sight of murder, it's because she was coughing. You know, Madeleine Albright, you know, broke the glass ceiling by being the first woman Secretary of State, but she's also a woman who excused the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children who died as a result of U.S. sanctions as worth it. That's what she called those deaths. Mm. At the same time as that's true, and I think Aminata's point is so correct about the celebrity aspect of it. So you have like Bollywood actresses who are feminists, but they endorse skin lightening creams. You know, there's no consequence to that. Nobody questions them for that. At the same time, they take away the space from real movements. So if we're looking at the protests in Lebanon that are happening right now, I mean, one of the early symbols of those protests was a woman who, when the protest movement had already come out to the streets, the Lebanese security forces were coming in to muscle people off the roads and to threaten them. And a private bodyguard of some minister took out a gun to fire in the air, and a woman kicked him in his groin after he shot. And she became very quickly a symbol of this protest movement. If we look at the movement in Chile, a lot of the students coming out to protest the hike in fares were women. So there are women who are not defanged, but they're not part of this process. They're edged out by, I mean, not to pile on to Reese Witherspoon, but...
Let's pile on.
But the Reese Witherspoons and the...
Yeah, she's fine.
She'll be okay.
Well, you know, one thing that what you're saying is making me think of, and the part of this conversation where I am willing to admit my complicity in this moment. I was like, I am not an ethical consumer in the way that I should be. We are all complicit under capitalism in some way. An institution that does not do that work is media. You know, I think that part of celebrity does not get to have a feminist moment if it is not enabled by media. Like, I don't give a shit about you know, like, it's a question that in U.S. media you see all the time. Like, a celebrity will get asked, like, are you a feminist? And 9 out of 10 times they say, no, I love men. And there's no follow-up. And I'm like a person with a high school education who does acting is not someone I am interested in hearing their opinion about, like, global events. But I think, like, it makes me think so much about how we are all forced to question where our place is in this. But I was like, it is not an accident that people who do nefarious things, like you are talking about celebrities, talking about these women CEOs who have like outsized power, I was like, they don't get that power out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And there is like one way to cut them off at the knees. And here's an institution that does not reckon with that.
Well, one thing that I always think about, like at one point in when I was writing my book, I was talking about how one consequence of the, you know, the most mainstream version of feminism has seemed to have is that there's this, that women have been able to fully maximize our capacity as market assets, as earners and as products. Whereas like so many things, like, you know, reproductive rights have been rolled back in the States, like all these, you know, I was saying, you know, like the minimum wage, whatever. And my editor, who I love, was like, wait, the minimum wage. And I was like, to me, the biggest feminist movements, the most interesting feminist movements in America are Fight for 15, Medicare for All, and the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And to me, like, those are the feminist movements that have the most heat for me. And they are getting covered more and more as such. But I think, like you were saying, like, what is, like, the place, the people who have not been defanged and the people who are, in fact, really doing the work, there is a visibility mismatch because of the economics of internet publishing, basically, and also failures of the media. But yeah,
I mean, I'm personally offended by the fact that just because we're women, we're supposed to get excited about the fact that Hollywood actresses want to be paid the same number of millions as their male co-stars. Like, that doesn't make you a feminist. That makes you a capitalist.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I
don't see why I have to now add my voice to that.
Yeah.
Especially when we consider that something like 2/3 of the world's illiterate population are women.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care if Sandra Bullock gets the same 10 million.
And that solidarity never trickles down. Like in the United States, in the early weeks of the Me Too movement, the women farm workers wrote this remarkable, took this remarkable ad out in the New York Times. First of all, taking a full page ad out in the New York Times is hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in a show of solidarity, these women farm workers were affirming the belief that they had in these celebrities' rights to tell their stories and to do that. And I was like, this is not, the reverse is never true.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, here are women farm workers who are saying, you are invited to the table, like you telling these awful stories of what had happened to you. We believe you. We want you to have that. I do not remember the last time that I saw women in corporate settings, whether it was in Hollywood or it was whatever, who were, they're inviting other people to the table instead of just trying to change conditions for themselves. And that lack of empathy is something that is reverberates through this conversation over and over again. And for me, that's always the tell.
Yeah.
It's, what do you want? Do you want it to be better for you? Or are you trying to change a system for everyone who is here?
Tracy, if I can come to you, just picking up on both the points that Fashima and Amanatu made. Last night in Sydney, when we were in conversation with Mona, you made a very interesting point about you're not interested in the gender pay gap conversation, which corporate feminism seems to be obsessed with. And I thought that your response was quite pertinent to today's conversation. I was curious if you could reflect on that a little bit more and why you're more interested in the conversation around ensuring that you know, we're not reinforcing inequality.
Well, if the only way that we understand justice, which is what I understand any sort of feminist womanist movement that is not centered in the very narrow U.S.-centric vein of feminism, which can actually be a quite ahistorical vein, the argument and the intellectual histories to which I subscribe have always talked about justice and redistribution and cooperative power, right? You can't get to any of those conversations by only understanding yourself as an economic subject, right? That in fact, the minute you adopt the language of economics being your value, your worth to a society, you adopt all of the racist, patriarchal, settler, colonialist ideologies that are embedded in the system of exchange. And so I think a narrow focus on wages then does a couple of things. First, it allows very wealthy women to do nominal representation work for poorer women, even as they use poorer women to remain wealthy. Mm-hmm. And so it says, yes, I'm very much in favor of my housekeeper being paid a livable wage, right? But then let's talk about what a housekeeper allows you to do. Does it allow a Reese Witherspoon, I don't mind either, a Sheryl Sandberg to organize a system of work and distribution that reinforces an unequal inheritance of wealth and privilege? Yes, yes, it does. Now, at the same time, I can say we live in the system, and until we blow the whole thing up, pay people enough to live and eat, but let's not understand the movement through that language because it delimits our imagination. And what feminism has always been about when it gets it right is reimagining the entire system of social organization, one where I can have absolutely no economic value and still have human value. Mm. That's feminism. Mm. So that is a feminism to me that accounts for some of the most powerful feminist work coming from disabled feminists, for example, that says, I want a system where my body does not have to be productive to an economic regime that will still allow me to be humane, right? For you to still see me as a productive human being. That to me is a powerful discourse that has very little purchase when we narrow an understanding of feminism to a set of policies that have to take necessarily their priors, that the only way to get there are through the existing policy regimes. So then we'll talk about wages, and we'll talk about, you know, whether or not people need 2 weeks off every year or four. By the way, we should have 18. And if I'm just throwing policy prescriptions out there, right? All very maybe meaningful sort of short-term things, but that is actually not to me a conversation about feminism. That's a conversation to me about citizenship, perhaps, and certainly social policy. But that's what narrowing the conversation to wages does. So it allows some sort of nominal solidarity without any actual solidarity. It delimits our imagination about how to be something more than an economic cog in the wheel. And frankly, it proliferates and sells to the rest of the world upon whom neoliberalization has depended to extract labor. We then turn around and sell back to them the idea of being good economic subjects. And so then what we take is from the rest of the world where feminism is doing exactly what radical feminism was supposed to do, which is reimagine the future, and we start to sell them on the idea of a student loan, on a job, on getting an internet connection. All lovely things, maybe, depending on who you are, but we then get to turn them into a market, right? Which then blunts the radical potential of feminism among the very people who are doing feminism's most important work. So I think this narrow focus on wages just excuses a lot of people and makes our cultural imagination very poorer for it.
I guess all of that said, and I want to direct this question to all of you, is it possible then to be a feminist and anti-capitalist? I think, Aminata, you talked about your own complicity within that, but I do wonder, is it possible if we are thinking about this reimagining of feminism?
To be feminist and anti-capitalist?
Yeah.
I would say that it's, to me it's almost one in the same. I mean, that being said, Like Tressie was saying, we live in a society, you know. I mean, let's say Fight for 15, right? It's like, this is improving people's lives strictly within, you know, as economic subjects, right? But to me, what that fight illuminates is that this is what capitalism at this stage makes of us, you know, like the end point of it is always anti-capitalist for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also it can't be it shouldn't be feminism unless it is suspicious of power and how that operates. Yeah. So whether that's capitalism, whether that's state power, you know, I mean, I always find it jarring when we're told to celebrate things like the fact that the head of the CIA is now a woman. You know?
Congratulations.
Yeah. Why do we, you know, why we're supposed to celebrate a waterboarder because she's a woman now? Or, you know, in America at least, I think if not four out of the top five, the largest defense companies in America are run by women now. I mean, that's not progress.
That's also not an accident.
That's not an accident.
I mean? Right.
Yeah.
I think that that's also, there are certain industries that thrive on putting people who look a certain way in certain jobs to seem that they are bulletproof. And so that doesn't surprise me in the least. But I also think that and Gia has said this so many times, this idea that we are supposed to, there is nowhere in, you know, like if there is a feminist Bible somewhere or, you know, like if somewhere we signed a contract that this something is feminism, it never once said that anything a woman does is feminist. Yeah. So where this idea is from is very, it concerns me a lot that this is a message that people have internalized.
Well, and like fully co-opted and weaponized, right? Like that's the,
and you're like, you know, I'm like, the point is, that's not the point to me. And I don't know where that comes from, but it really, I am deeply concerned that that is a thing that people believe, because that is just another way of blunting the instrument of saying, well,
very powerful and like typical neutralizing tactic, right? So, which Gia has written very beautifully about the acceleration that technology affords us. One of the negative, I think, consequences of that acceleration is how quickly modes of resistance can be turned into a consumer good, right? So when you can buy a shirt that says future feminist baby, I am a feminist, you know, shut up unless you're saying feminism, I don't know, whatever they're now selling at the local store, right? How quickly those ideas can be turned into commodity says, I think, a couple of things about how powerful the idea has become, but also then how vulnerable the idea has become. And technology does like accelerate that, which is why it is almost all consuming now, I think, to be in a social movement, because you have to be traveling at this speed, you know, that's so much faster than the ability to co-opt those ideas. And I do think the capitalist industries have become very good at extracting the brand from the work and then selling it back to you. I think because many of us, because again, it is hard. It's very hard to live your ideals. It is harder when you have to live it in a society that's benefiting from all that global inequality, because you almost have to live it alone, you know, when there isn't like this big active sort of social movement or community around you. It is hard to make all of the right anti-capitalist choices. And in fact, sometimes it's impossible. I mean, frankly, I'm not going to eat sometimes if Amazon doesn't bring me my food, right? Like, and I don't know how feminist it is to die from hunger because I need to wait for the good worker cooperative grocery store to open tomorrow at 8 a.m. It's hard.
Yeah.
It is difficult to make those decisions, but that is also by design. But then the point is that our individual decisions in that way can't then be feminism. It can't be what I buy. Yeah. It can't be who I support as a CEO or something like that. I do think it has to be about the actions that one takes, because the actions are the part that actually can't be easily commodified. The sloganeering can be commodified.
And it's also like who, I think it's very convenient that people who look like us are the people that are asked to make those choices when we are not the people who contribute the most to the system. And that's also not an accident at all, that we are asked to justify every choice that we make when the people who have more power than us are the ones that say that feminism is, I choose my choice. I was like, I don't believe that to be what I'm doing, but there is no ethical conception under capitalism that is true, and we live in the system. But again, it strikes me who is asked to make that choice more.
I also, another thing that I think that technology does is, like, you know, the internet is a decontextualization machine, effectively, right? And I think when you talk about like women accruing power, it's like the context is everything, right? Like, it's sort of like the internet has taken a lot of things that are incredibly necessary, and it's generalized the concept. Let's overgeneralize the concept and then redirected it towards the people that need it least. Like, the internet has taught a lot of people that they shouldn't be ashamed, and now only the wrong people. You know what I mean? And it's the same with, like, you know, the fact that I do think that there is a generation of young women, especially, who within the last 10 years have learned that sometimes the narratives imposed on their lives are incorrect, and they've learned to read their lives in a feminist way. And then you get people like Gina Haspel being, and then it gets put back on people like Gina Haspel being head of the CIA. And it's like the context is so stripped from what narratives we should be celebrating in what contexts. And then it just becomes like any woman getting any amount of power is a feminist act. And it's just the internet has that like constant decontextualization. Mm.
Fatima, in terms of thinking about solutions, I mean, one of the things that I think about a lot, particularly in the Australian context, is when we have conversations in the mainstream around feminism, it's generally about the gender pay gap. It's generally about women getting onto boards and quotas. But a lot of working class women, women from migrant refugee backgrounds, Indigenous women, can't even access economic opportunities. And I wonder, how do you steer the conversation to ensure that the women that can't even get a job have access to employment and can actually look after their families, and that, you know, being very aware that we are entangled in capitalism, but there's obviously room to move and make choices that can hopefully empower other women that wouldn't necessarily have those opportunities.
Well, I think that's, again, back to what Aminata was saying, is that we're always asked to provide those answers, but when the CEO of Pepsi is on a stage, nobody asks her about that. Nobody asks her about the farmers dying of suicide. Because they, you know, because they can't survive because of the pollution of the water systems. Thanks to, I mean, they don't get asked that. I mean, I've never seen a CEO get asked an uncomfortable question anywhere. I mean, I'm still waiting.
Yeah, CEOs are not supposed to ever be uncomfortable.
They're not supposed
to.
That's
right. You're a CEO.
They just get this kind of this like stroking. They're just constantly stroked, and then we have to provide solutions. And I think that's where the conversation always hits a wall. One of the things that I found really interesting when I was working on this last book of mine is I was writing about cultures outside of the West in the global South and how these cultures, who've all undergone neoliberal reforms at around the same time, how their societies really are turned upside down and how their power, their culture, everything is disarticulated. And after the war economy, neoliberalism is really puts its fangs and its claws into culture. One of the most fascinating things that I learned came from Peru. As they undergo these neoliberal reforms in the 1990s, so much is unbalanced in Peru. People are disassociated from the land. People are the family is broken, you know, as people are migrating away from villages into the city. It comes at the same time as the Shining Path guerrilla movement, which of course is a byproduct of that kind of ferocious inequality. And one of the things that happens is that spaces like cinemas get broken down. They get shut down because they've got to be pushing out money all the time, so they become parking lots and all that stuff that we already know. And a fascinating thing happens in the highlands of Peru, which is that this generation of filmmakers is being born. And they're not growing up watching films in the cinema, they're watching really old Bollywood films on VHS, on cassettes. And the stuff they start to produce are horror movies. And it's like exclusively horror movies. It's not, they're not doing dramas, they're not doing TV shows. And there's this, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, so if there's a Peruvian here, please correct me. There's a film called The Pistaco, and it's a horror film about a gringo, about a white person who needs to feed his factory, and what he does is he takes the fat of local people to feed the machines in his factory. And I think it's a beautiful parable, and it's a beautiful story of how life is disrupted and how people's access to just anything, to jobs, to fairness, is overturned by neoliberalism. At the same time, where is that in feminist conversations? Where is that in feminist culture? I think we have to ask that of more than just us. And until we do that, until Broadside invites CEOs and asks them that question, I'm not sure what the rest of us are supposed to do except remember. and remind.
Would you agree with that, Tressie?
Yeah, I think, yes, I absolutely would. I do, in these moments, think how scary it is that we cannot imagine another way of living, and so we end up reproducing the system that's trying to kill us. And so I suspect that the answer is in a language that we haven't written yet, which is why in times of extreme political violence and oppression, art does become so very important, because it does help a community articulate a way of understanding the world that allows them to reimagine it rather than reproducing it. And I think, I will say only for myself, that you can become so mired in the minutia of, yes, how your water's being poisoned and who's responsible for what vote got stolen this week and what is happening, you know, in that part of the world and this conflict and what is happening there, that we may be the worst subjects to ask how to fix it. I certainly feel often that I am, because being part of the generation that I think is that is existing in the transition of a social transformation, I feel like our job is to record it, unfortunately. And recording is not that useful for reimagining. It's important. It's going to serve a role. But I document what is happening. I say often that I don't want us to wake up one day and say that no one tried to tell us. You know, I don't want it to ever be said that this thing happened and it didn't exist anywhere in some archive. But that's me accepting, I think, that certain parts of that neoliberalism has won in many regards. And so that would make me the worst subject for reimagining. But I'm not the only subject, and that's the exciting thing, which is what Fatima's pointing out, that there are people who are absolutely doing it, but one, we're not asking them, and we certainly aren't putting them on level on the same stage and in the same conversation and discourse of, I think, the worst actors of the excesses of this sort of capitalist machine. So I don't know the right answers. I do know that it doesn't come through the language that we already have available to us.
Can I just say also, I think what Tressie said is so important. Reimagining is vital and urgent, but we also need a space for our anxieties, mm-hmm. I think,
yeah.
You know, don't we? And I think that's mm-hmm. why the Peruvian story for me is so important.
Yeah.
That's a space of anxiety, of fear. And yet we're always asking people who are suffering the brunt of the system to be hopeful mm-hmm. about its collapse. That's difficult. That takes time.
Very quickly, I want to get your thoughts on this, Gia and Aminatu, before I get the audience questions. Are you in agreement with Fatima and Tressie?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I got chills when Tressie said that it's... I mean, I often feel... I mean, I have this feeling every day that I'm not... I am so formed by the system that I can't... I don't have the words for what we need. And at the same time, I often think... So many of the things that give us anxiety about climate, about whatever. I mean, like, basic, I don't know, like, prison abolition, like, open borders and expropriating every billionaire's wealth. Like, it's like how much that could do. You know, it's like that's not a new system, but there are levers. Like, there are things that I can imagine. Like, so much wealth and opportunity is locked up in so few people's hands. And I often, like I think that there's this sense of scarcity right now, and there's not actually scarcity, you know? There is so, like in America, it's like I'm always like, well, this is like the wealthiest society that's ever existed, and we are making people feel like they have nothing. And there are levers to pull that could change that if we had a certain kind of, you know, if we were able to push certain policy things through.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with so much of what everyone has said. I think I'm also thinking so much about the intersections of all of these things. You know, when I think about the feminism that is racist does not have the imagination to get out of capitalism. The feminism that is ableist does not have the imagination to do that either, right? And so it to me, it's just really a call to to really think about like what we are talking about when we're talking about getting free of capitalism, because I think that some of us are in agreement, but a lot of us don't know what that means. It is not just about freeing ourselves from the means of production. I was like, it is really, you know, as we say in America, shaking the table. This mm-hmm. is serious. And so I think that I think about that a lot. I love that Peruvian story that you told, because it's not that it's giving me hope as much as it reminds me that even in the midst of oppression, people still have a voice, you know? And like I would not know that story if you hadn't said it today. And it is going to stay with me for a really long time, and it gave me chills, because I think that is possible. And there, you know, and the art that will come out of this time and a lot of the conversations that we're having, I think that they will be meaningful for a generation that is not us. I've been thinking a lot, I've been reading a lot about suffrage since I've been here, because it turns out Australians gave us suffrage, apparently. Or they gave the white people in America suffrage. But when I think about the fight for suffrage in the United States, and thinking about how it was a 100-year movement where most of the people, well, not most, every single one of the women who, you know, were there at the beginning for that, none of them survived to see suffrage got ratified in the United States. That is a reminder to me of just everything takes time, and this fight is not a fight for my generation. I was like, I am thoroughly shaped by the system that I am in, but what I really want is to be able to feel like I was a good ancestor for another generation. And I was like, that is the best that I can do.
Yeah.
You know, and until someone asks the CEOs and the girl bosses what they're doing, I don't know what they're doing. But I think that for me, the mandate is that, is I like, will I be a good ancestor? And that is the thing that like gets me out of bed every day. And, you know, and only time will answer that question.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I think we've got a question. And also just note, if you could kindly make your questions brief.
And questions,
yes. A question mark at the end is very important.
In this current system, as a disabled woman, and I say disabled woman because I'm disabled by society, not by my inherent capacity for life, I'm deemed worthless. What social system can I exist in?
Let me make sure. Did anybody hear the full?
It was difficult to hear.
Yeah, I think if I understood correctly, you said that as someone that's considered disabled, worthless by society, as someone that identifies as disabled, how do you... I didn't quite catch the last...
I don't produce, I don't earn, I can't buy... Mm-hmm. What model can I live in, like actually survive in? Because I'm grappling with the question right now. It's a pretty urgent question to me and others like me.
Yeah, it's actually a particularly urgent question, I think, to many people. If we are, as they say where I'm from, if you're fortunate to live old enough to be useless, that's actually everybody's destiny. You know, we will all, our usefulness to a capitalist machine, you only end up one of two ways. You die young enough that you died at the peak of your usefulness to the machine, or you outlive your usefulness to the machine. So it's actually an urgent question for us all, which is, and so what social system, a consumption society cannot be an equal or just society. And that's what we've learned. The limits of our ability to consume or be consumed or participate in the cycle of consumption, meaning our ability to buy and to sort of keep that machine going, will always exacerbate our vulnerabilities in that system. But here's the thing that I think is like really useful to remember, you know, like other people have lived other ways. This is not, we don't actually have to like design something from, you know, the stars or something. There have been systems of organization that would understand different bodies differently. We are not restricted to this one. And in fact, there's an argument to be made that depending on where you are in the world, you actually can step out of some of the extremes of consumption, if only because the country is kept so perniciously poor, they're not able to consume. But so there are other systems of social organization that have a different relationship to consumption, where one's value to that system would be quite different. But that's an urgent question for us all, and I think the question for a feminism that would be thought of as liberatory as opposed to one that would be thought of as oppressive, which is, can it imagine a system where our worth is not based on our ability to consume? That actually, I think, feeds into lots of the other questions. It feeds into the issues of climate change. It feeds into issues of whether or not, you know, an economic system can be just. It feeds into issues about disability, about racism, about colonialism. That's kind of solving the heart of that fundamental question is actually part of it, whether a feminism can imagine that.
Can I say there are two books, Against Creativity and Inventing the Future, that both address this, that actually the situation that you're describing is the fertile situation that illuminates what use actually is, which is not use as we understand it, use and worth as we understand it under capitalism, that this situation that many that is impossibly hard to be in under our current situation is the lane that opens to what should be. Both of those books were very helpful for me for thinking through this.
And we'll take a question from upstairs.
Hello. Thank you so much for the conversation. I'd really love to know, in relation to women who are living in homes where they're experiencing domestic abuse or domestic violence and they can't afford to leave those spaces, they can't afford to be free because they don't have the money or the earning capacity or they're because of the way this economic system is set up. I wonder what we can do to afford women who are in those situations the opportunity to leave or some economic freedom. Or is this system that we're in, this breadwinner economy, does that make that kind of impossible?
Who wants to take that one on?
Tressie. I want to know what you think.
Sociologist, yeah. Right? Well, I'm going to call here on feminist organizations who have practiced cooperative economics for a very long time. So one way to survive in a system of capitalism that finds your body not at full utility or the utility that is valued at any particular time in the economy is to rely on cooperative economics. So it is not a reimagining of a system, but it is a means of survival and thriving in a predatory system. And so I'm familiar with actually their U.S., mostly U.S.-based organizations who have for generations practiced cooperative community building that is centered on providing avenues of freedom for women who are living in domestic violence situations, which again gets back to this question that there is another way to think about exchanges. So this is an exchange of services and goods and relational ties, which I would actually say that if you want to know how that works, you can look at pretty much any indigenous community where you are who has had to survive in very hostile economic and political regimes. You will find that those communities rely very deeply and heavily on social ties. Like, there is a way to build kinship networks of care for each other that do not necessitate a direct economic exchange, and that there are many, many communities who actively practice that and usually are practicing it right there in your local community. They are usually the marginalized populations who do it out of necessity, but also do it because they have a history of doing it. That's how their system, their communities have been organized for a very long time. So, you know, a social policy, of course, would be one that would provide direct economic resources to women who are in danger. But actually, what we know from lots of social science is that can actually make some women more vulnerable. You give them money, and that can actually make them more vulnerable to their abuser. It's leaving actually takes money, but it also takes a lot more than money. It takes people to care for you, to help care for your children. It takes people to protect you, to protect your identity and your location and that kind of thing. So it's actually more as much care as it is about money. And that can actually be built right where you are, and I would actually hazard a guess that it already exists right here where we are, whether we know it, whether you know about it or not.
I always feel in the case of countries like Pakistan that it's less a question of economics and more a question of literacy and knowledge. Is that how does a woman find out where those organizations are and that they exist if she doesn't have, I mean, forget functional literacy, but even phone literacy or internet literacy.
Yeah.
That's a big problem in countries like mine.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so we can't get to all your questions. And as you gathered, there's still a lot to unpack from this conversation, but hopefully it's left you with enough to think about. But please join me in thanking our very wonderful panelists, Aminatu, Gia, Tressy, and Fatima.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.